Hello and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are inaugurating the podcast phase of the life history of Connecting the Dots today. I am your host, Mark Shea, and today we have a special guest, a friend of mine I got to know a couple of months back, a guy named Andrew March. He's actually been on the show before. If you go to the Podbean archives, you can go find Andrew's show with us, and I thought it would be fun to have him back to inaugurate the podcast. Andrew is Protestant, not Catholic. He's a church planter, speaker, blogger. In addition to being on the leadership team of his church, Cell 53, he is a member of the group Pro-Life Missionaries of Maine. So he lives up there in Maine, the purpose of which, by the way, is not the purpose of living in Maine. The purpose of being part of Pro-Life Missionaries of Maine is to fight for the lives of the unborn. He blogs from his website, breakinggray.com. Andrew is one of the hosts of Cell 53 Radio, and he resides with his family in Lewiston, Maine. And his hobbies include thumping on things. You've got a good mic. How you doing?
Pretty good, Matt. Well, I think I'm going to have to change my intro there to fighting for the lives of the unborn and then born,
Yeah.
considering our current climate.
Well, that is something that the pro-life movement desperately needs to do, and we are living this show is being recorded just as Congress, or the House at any rate, is voting to repeal and destroy. They're not going to replace. They're voting to repeal and destroy Obamacare, and to inflict massive damage on our healthcare system and screw and kill, because that's what it really comes back to, kill a lot of people. This is a something that has been zealously supported. The National Right to Life Committee, I think, has come out enthusiastically in favor of this act of vandalism to the American healthcare system because something something abortion. It
Right.
punishes Planned Parenthood, so that's all that matters. And so we've now got under this system, we've got a system that is going to. Oh, what were you reading just a minute ago? We were talking before we went on the air.
Yeah,
What
so
is what are some of the effects of this act of vandalism?
I've got a friend who is obviously, she's on the liberal side of things, and she was having a meltdown on Facebook. I said, "Look, I'm about to jump on this podcast. I need you to let me tell me some of these issues." And one of them was, we're going to broaden what the term pre-existing conditions mean as far as insurance, as far as what an insurance company would be duty-bound to cover. And so she starts explaining to me that rape, sexual assault, it's very possible that sexual assault itself could be classified as one of these pre-existing. Of course, after a woman has endured that sort of trauma, there are psychological, emotional, mental, physical issues that are the fallout of that.
That I get to
And
suck it up. I mean, women
well,
are they're resilient. So they don't need
At the
coverage at
time,
all.
I said, "This is madness." So I called you up. We had the conversation. I said, "Is this true? Is this possible?"
It's damn
And
right
so
it's true.
I Googled it. Actually, on CNN, it's worse than what my friend said. It's rape and domestic violence.
Yeah. Pre-existing conditions.
And so, I mean, that's just one of many possible. Now, this is literally happening as we speak.
Right.
So maybe some amendments might happen. Maybe they change something or whatever. But I'm looking at CNN right now, and whatever you want to say, I'm reading it right from CNN, and they're not, whatever you want to say, they're slanted one way or the other. They wouldn't make this up.
Right.
So I
Well, and
think
it's
for
not just
me.
on CNN either. The article I was reading was talking about how Trump's plan is also, just as an extra special bonus, is going to drive the cost of maternity up of more than 400%. Now, guess what happens when poor people, can't afford to have a baby. Guess what they're tempted to do?
Well, I want people to understand. I want people to understand here because I'm not speaking theoretically. I'm out there. We go out there every Friday.
Right.
So I've talked to these flesh and blood human beings, okay?
Right.
And the fact of the matter is, because of their economic situation, I'll tell you one story. We had one girl, we turned her around, praise God. But what happened was, because of her economic situation, she went into basically trafficking herself. And then she got pregnant. And she said, basically, the idea was, look, I went into trafficking because I'm broke. How in the world can I take care of a child?
Right.
And that was under Obamacare.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
So let the implications of that just settle in your mind.
Right.
It's unbelievable.
Right. The great, colossal blunder of the pro-life movement, and the thing that has made it a scandal and a hissing, has been, you know, people say that the pro-life movement is a one-issue movement. Unfortunately, that's not really true. Would that it were. Would that it really took seriously not only the effects of abortion, but the causes of it and why people seek abortions, and really started to look at the totality of the human person. Because if it did, it would be outraged at what the GOP is doing to the healthcare system right now, because the choices that are being made right now guarantee you that the abortion rate is going to go up under Trump, because it turns out that merely limiting access to abortion isn't going to solve the problem. If you don't look at why people go, if you look only at supply and never look at demand and pay no attention to demand and do everything in your power to raise demand, you're going to get more abortions. And that's what's happening right now.
Well, the most cynical side of me, and we've had folks in the movement that would probably be considered the fringe right of the pro-life movement, come on our show and said that many in the pro-life movement want abortion to continue because it's an industry in and of itself, meaning being anti-abortion is a segment of the abortion industry.
Right.
Because as long as you have this big bag boogeyman to fight,
right,
then you get funding and you get all this craziness happening. And so part of me is like, this is going to create way more abortions than stymie. And the fact of the matter is, under Obama's regime, whatever you want to call it, abortion downtrended significantly.
Yeah, it did.
And there are multiple reasons for that, whatever you want to call it. So on the one hand, he himself was aggressively pro-choice, quote-unquote. But the effect of his policies, along with the rise of abolitionism in our country, reduced abortion significantly.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've got a quote-unquote evangelical Republican in office who is no doubt going to aid and abet in the increasing of abortion due to these insane policies.
Right.
It's and unbelievable.
This goes back. One of the things that really began to dawn on me, this is a problem on, you know, this is a problem for Protestants and Catholics. Catholics are complicit in this as well. You've got this approach that said, and again, would that it were really true, that said that abortion is the biggest moral issue of our time. But where the time and energy has actually gone in support for Trump and his party and all that they stand for, it hasn't gone toward stopping abortion. That's not where the time and energy goes. Where the time and energy goes to, right now, defending raising maternity rates 400%. It goes toward defending the abominable idea that rape is a pre-existing condition, and so tough nuts for you. It goes toward defending the idea that Trump is not a sex predator. He's just somebody who talks big. You know, and this kind of thing, it goes toward defending, you know, the idea of, you know, wouldn't it be kind of cool if we wound up having a nuclear exchange with North Korea to show how tough we are?
Right.
It goes toward defending all of these outrageous things, right?
Right.
It doesn't go toward stopping abortion. It goes toward, in essence, defending everything that Trump and his party do.
Yeah, or we did a,
or maintaining a stony silence about it.
Yeah, we did a show on Syria where Trump sent those rockets over.
Right,
and of course it was horrible. You know, the chemical attack. Bashar al-Assad. I mean, he's a war criminal.
Sure, he is.
He should be dealt with. But the only point that I made in criticism of Trump, because I'm very reserved, even now, and I said, hey, this is happening as we speak, so we're not particularly sure what the end game is here.
Right.
But my thought on the whole rocket thing was, it wasn't even 7 days from when this gas attack happened that he's launching 50-plus Tomahawk missiles over there in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't it take a little bit more time to ascertain who did what and who we should, you know, be the hand of God to and all the rest of it. I got so much flack from my evangelical friends for daring to criticize.
He's a hero.
The Fuhrer for...
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, it's real. That is the problem that we face right now, is we have a pro-life movement that, in the main, does not think in terms of a consistent ethic of life, that in fact attacks a consistent ethic of life. So, you know, statistically, if you self-identify as a faithful pro-life conservative Christian, Protestant or Catholic, the odds are extremely high that you were an enthusiastic supporter of the war in Iraq, a war that met zero criteria for just war. Was condemned by two popes and all the bishops of the world, which ought to matter to Catholics at least, but didn't. The odds are very good. A 2009 Pew Research poll showed that conservative Christians, Protestant and evangelical and Catholic, had a higher enthusiastic support for the use of torture than the general population of the United States, which already thought torture was pretty cool. But evangelical Christians and conservative Catholics were in the lead. They were the vanguard of cheering for what Catholic theology says is a mortal sin, grave intrinsic evil. There is no way, according to actual church teaching, that the use of torture can ever be morally justified, ever. It is a sin that will send you to hell just as surely as performing an abortion will.
An abortion, yeah.
But conservative Catholics loved it. And one of the ways that they argued for it was saying it's not as bad as abortion is. And in fact, well, it's good.
Of course, many, and if there's anybody that's against the evils of abortion, it's me.
Right.
But if you want to start grasping, you know, picking at the details here, the folks who died in Abu Ghraib over there in Iraq,
right,
suffered weeks of torture,
right,
before they expired,
right,
weeks. So if that's a level of justification, it's worse than abortion. If you want to go to that, this is just ridiculous.
Right.
And I don't know. I don't know on your side how influential the hard right Catholic bloc was, but it goes without speaking that if Trump didn't have the overwhelming support, and I'm going to say it, Mark, of white evangelicals, right, he would not be in office today. It's a fact.
Right. No, absolutely. Yeah.
It's a fact. And so we got to do, you know, and we did a show.
See, now we come down to it. That's the real issue, isn't it? Because you're black. And so
Right, right.
You know, this is all lives matter, Andrew.
Right.
You know, all lives matter right up. You know, they matter when I remember I saw some stand-up comedies of black guy going, think about that. You know, the slogan black lives, it's, we're not saying black lives are better than everyone else's. It's just they matter. And even just they matter is like too much.
Yeah,
we did a show. Matter, right?
We did a show right after the election. It was an emergency show, and I said, "Look, I'm here in Lewiston, Maine. All right, I am the minority.
Right.
I understand that most of my evangelical white brothers and sisters voted for Donald Trump and did so heartily. Okay,
right,
and so I." Love you as a brother, a sister, or a mother in the faith. I will not hesitate to worship next to you.
Mm-hmm.
But now, when all this madness comes out, we have to deal with the fallout and do some soul searching as to why this man appealed so much to us. And I'm saying us because from a covenantal perspective, when you're in covenant with a group of people, their sin kind of becomes your sin at some level. And so... even though I was not for voting for Trump, I'm going to throw in with my family and say, okay, we got to do some soul searching as evangelicals and figure out what the heck was going on in our minds and our hearts that made us not only hold our nose and vote for the man,
right,
but vote for him passionately.
Yeah.
That's the issue.
And that is the issue. That's really the issue. I get, and the same thing on the Catholic side of the fence. I got it totally. You know, I don't like Hillary Clinton. I never liked Hillary Clinton, right? And she was, manifestly, you can see this because she lost. She was a
terrible... But she took responsibility for it.
Oh, totally. Yes, it was... I take full responsibility. It's Comey's fault. But
and the Russians.
And the Russians. I take absolute full responsibility. But that was the thing. Boy. You know, okay, look. People said at the time of the election, and I got this, I got it then, I totally disagreed, but okay, let's grant. She was the worst of the two candidates. I don't believe that for one second. And I think that she just sucked as a candidate, but still not the worst. She was the lesser of two evils. By the way, a little clarification here. Catholic moral teaching never, ever, ever says you can support the lesser of two evils. I don't know. I can't speak for evangelicals, but here's Catholic moral teaching. Catholic moral teaching says you cannot support evil, period, right? evil is a thing that you can't support. Supporting evil is called sinning. So you cannot support the lesser of two evils. What you can do is you can work to lessen evil. There's a huge moral distinction there.
Yes.
You can try to lessen evil. You can never say, I am in favor of this little evil.
Of course, some of this that you the angle that you may not have looked at as well is the unique distinctive of evangelical eschatology, which for those who still hold to, and most, you know, older generation white conservative evangelicals still hold to a lot of left behind theology. And in that theology, the world is going to get inevitably progressively worse until we get out of here. So I literally had someone on the show say, look, this world is screwed. And I just want it basically as best as it can possibly be for my daughter and my grandkids. And so that's how I'm making that decision. Because eventually the Antichrist is going to take over, and you don't want to pave the way for the Antichrist and Hillary Clinton. I mean, literally, that's where it's going. So that was a mindset for a lot of evangelicals. I'm not joking.
Yeah, okay.
You wouldn't believe it. If the world is going to get progressively worse, and you're only going to get horrible candidates from here, and there's nothing you can do to affect positive change in a permanent sense,
right?
Then... just throw in the towel and there you go. So there you go.
That's a problem.
Believe me, it is for sure.
So great. But popularly speaking, you get a lot of people who say, I voted for Trump because he's the lesser of two evils. Okay, fine. I'll grant all of that. But if you, if that really were what you were doing, then one of the things that I didn't vote, I live in a very, very blue state, Washington. And so I knew that Hillary was going to win the electoral vote here in Washington, whatever happens, which meant that I didn't need to vote for her. Because that was already taken care of. If I lived in a swing state, because I knew that Trump was manifestly visible from space, the worser of the two candidates, it was plain to me that since that was the reason being, he supports every evil that Hillary does, plus a whole lot of other evils that she didn't support, and he's an incompetent, crazy narcissist, you know, who thinks that nuclear weapons are kind of cool, you know?
Yes.
You know, she's a narcissist. Pretty much everybody that runs for president is a narcissist, but Trump is beyond the beyond.
So, I liked Bernie. I really
did. I liked him too. There was no hope for him, but I think that he's a civic minded person. But at any rate, so my motto was, if I lived in a swing state, I would not merely feel morally free to vote for Hillary, I would feel morally bound to vote for Hillary before God. But since I didn't live in a swing state, I went ahead and I voted for the candidate of the American Solidarity Party, who, because they actually have a platform that I don't hold my nose over, I actually support. So all of that. But okay, granted, though. Okay, I'm voting for Trump because he's the lesser of the two evils. Okay, fine. If that's the case, then what you are really saying, and I would have said this had I voted for Hillary in a swing state, is that the moment your candidate is elected, that becomes the moment that you stop supporting them.
That's right.
And the moment that you begin to fight every evil that they advocate.
Right.
And I,
because if he's the lesser of two evils, then you're saying he's evil.
He's evil and he has to be resisted. Right, exactly. And that's not what I'm seeing. I'm not seeing this from Christians who supported Trump. What I have seen, and this is the thing, this is kind of one of those Breaking Bad kind of things. You know, you go into evil because you have some good cause. But right. The problem is that the evil consumes you.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening here. So we have now a pro-life, quote-unquote, movement that just voted to do exactly what it was denouncing a few years ago. It's essentially turned the healthcare system into a vast death panel. And
of course, evangelicals, I don't know about conservative Catholics, but evangelicals have canonized the capitalist economic system.
Sure.
And yeah. So when people say Obamacare was socialized medicine, and I say yes, and they go, well, that's socialism. Okay. Well, we're supposed to be capitalist. You honestly believe that Jesus Christ was a capitalist?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I was watching a clip with Ron Paul, and he said, there was this one clip in a debate where he says, why does everybody think that we have a moral obligation to take care of people? And everybody was clapping.
Yay!
And I was saying, wait a second. I said, do you believe that? And they said, yeah. They said, healthcare isn't a human right. I said, are you okay? Well, there goes a good Samaritan.
Yeah.
Well,
okay. And that's it. You know what libertarianism does at the end of the day is it says, you know what? The priest and the Levite did exactly the right thing.
Right. I mean, if you want to be a good Samaritan, good for you, but you don't want to codify that into actual Sharia, an actual law.
Yeah, that would be bad.
And you got to, you know, hey, you should have been walking down. You know, a libertarian would say, well, he knew that road was dangerous. He should have been walking down that road.
Yeah.
or or they'll say you should have had a sword or whatever.
Yeah.
These people.
And that's yeah.
It's madness.
The real problem, you know, with the guy on the road was that he wasn't carrying a gun.
He wasn't packing.
He should have stood his ground.
Yeah, it's also Christus Exemplar to go blast somebody into the into the greater eternal state.
Your enemy if your enemy strikes you on the right cheek, then blow his head off. That
blow his head off. Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is so we're living in an hour now where pro-life Christians have just said that it is fantastic that rape victims have their coverage denied as a pre-existing condition, that they are cheering for kicking. The reason this bill failed the first time is because the Freedom Caucus didn't think that it was cruel enough. So they had to send it back to make sure that it was even crueler.
Yeah.
And that was really the goal. So they've got what they wanted now. And they're gonna begin destroying healthcare for the next couple of years. What are silver linings? Well, one possible silver lining, and this is a tragic thing to have to say. One silver lining is that maybe the people who voted for all of these guys, who are now going to be the ones that suffer for this. Lyndon Johnson once made the observation, he's right, he's saying this at the height of the conflict over the Civil Rights Act, and he said, if you can convince the lowest white man that he's better than the best black man, he will not only hand you can not only pick his pocket, but he will hand you money. I hate to say it, but a lot of what's driving this and a lot of what drove the popularity of Trump's election was exactly the proposition that we are going to punish those brown people. They're going to finally get what's coming to them. And so, we're going to get the Mexican rapists, and we're going to get all those people who are, picking your cantaloupes for you because they're the problem. And we're gonna get those, as Trump famously said, of Syrian refugee children, I will look them in the eye and tell them you can't come. And so much of what's driving this has been this hope that finally we poor whites are going to finally get our vengeance on people who are even weaker and poorer than we are. Well,
yeah.
The thing is that Trump and the people who just voted for this regard everybody south of their tax bracket as their prey. And so a lot of the people that voted for these guys are themselves going to be really cruelly punished by this healthcare bill. And the only hope that I can see coming out of this is that they will finally wake up and realize how much they've been scammed and how much they themselves are going to suffer for this, and figure out that we got to get rid of these guys. I don't know that that's going to happen.
Well, it's, a guy like Bernie, was essentially, part of his message was, look, they're trying to play both sides against the middle here. You're not the enemy. The other guy isn't the enemy. We got to work together against the folks who are really taking advantage of us.
Right.
And Trump.
But that's socialism. That is socialism, Andrew.
Well, the crazy thing is Hillary was, and the DNC destroyed that.
I know. I know.
So, I think Trump is the greatest argument to these blue collar Rust Belt folks that were saying this is our guy. about 8 months in, when they realized, wait a second,
you are so screwed. They're gonna figure that. You hope they're gonna figure that out. You know.
Yeah, that crazy Jewish guy with the crazy hair is gonna look very appealing next you hope. Term. So
you hope.
Inshallah, as my Muslim friends say, inshallah, it'll happen.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. Last week, the Democrats, in their infinite wisdom, said You know what we really need to? It's all hands on deck. Trump has to be stopped. The GOP is about to destroy the healthcare system. What should we do? What should we? I know. Let's tell a third of our party, the pro-life Dems, that you are not wanted. Get the hell out of our party.
Right.
That's a smart thing to do.
Right.
And so you can always count on the Democrats to do the dumbest possible thing. But
they still don't get it. That was the thing. I saw that. I was like, these guys still.
They don't get it.
You would think it's impossible, but they still don't get it.
Yeah.
And that was mind-blowing to me.
Yeah.
That was mind-blowing to me. I want to talk about the Blessed Mother.
Let's do that. Because you know what? The Blessed Mother is the mother of the unborn. But she's also, it turns out, the mother of the sick and all the baptized and everybody else too.
Well, actually, I said, you know, this angle of this topic does kind of bleed into what I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, so absolutely.
We had a again, for clarification, I'm a Protestant. I'm a Protestant. But I am not afraid of Mary. The scripture says, she says in the scriptures, from now on, all people will call me blessed. And she is the mother. And my perspective on Mary is that Eve is called the mother of all the living. Sarah is called the mother of faithful women. And so if Mary is blessed among all the women, then I have no problem with calling her my mother in any way, shape, or form, or a Fantastic. Mother in church or whatever. I don't care. I'm not afraid of Mary. You want to come at me, come at me. Anyway.
Okay.
I'm a Protestant. I don't pray to her. I don't do it. I'm still Protestant, but I have a very, very high regarded admiration, ton of admiration for her. And I think that, I mean, okay, anyway, so here was my thought, Mark. Are you ready for this?
Hit me.
It might just be, you know, just complete.
Some background, by the way, for the listener out there. So yesterday, Andrew writes me and says, I had this idea about the Blessed Mother, and I want to run it past you. I said, I have an idea. Instead of running it past me now, let's talk about it on the show tomorrow.
Right.
And so that's why Andrew is here. So I don't know what Andrew's going to say next.
So Mark is getting this as you are. Well, no. Well, yes. In a sense. All right.
Okay.
So here's what happened, Mark. There's this woman in an evangelical church who had the nerve to start nursing her child in the church.
What? Oh, like during the service, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
And now our church, we're a family integrated church, so we've got babies, kids. We don't have a nursery. Okay. Some of that is theological conviction. Some of that, honestly, is just we're broke. We're a bunch of kids who started a church. Okay?
Oh, so you're a Catholic parish then?
Right. So we have nursing mothers, and they'll go and take care of their business. Now they have the little slip cover thingamajig, but we also have an African population where we are.
Okay.
And culturally speaking, they don't do that.
Now, I was going to say, that's not the first thing that I would think about Maine.
Yeah.
I was just not something that I've ever given any thought, but it just wouldn't occur to me that you would have a large African population in Maine.
Oh, yeah. We have a huge Somali population.
Also, like African-African.
Oh, yeah.
Not African-American.
We've got no. We've got people from Ghana. We've got people.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Oh yeah. They've nicknamed our area Mogadishu.
okay.
And of course the evangelicals were on the forefront of saying we can't take any more of these refugees. Okay. But that's a different story.
Yeah. Probably.
Of course.
Okay.
And so I walk into church one day and there's this African lady and she's taking care of her business. Now me, I was born in Jamaica, so it's not a controversial thing for me at all.
Okay.
I was, she's taking care of her kid. Let's go. Now, this church, obviously, they didn't have that perspective, and so out she went, right?
Okay.
And so we were discussing this on the show, and my angle on it was, look, when I think about pro-life, when I think about babies and nurturing and things of that nature, I'm not just worried about the kid inside the womb.
Right.
Because many times, as we have just demonstrated with the pro-life movement, if the kid makes it outside the womb, he's screwed after that. So to me, it's just this beautiful picture of motherhood and all this and that. Well, anyway, I started going through a biblical theology of motherhood and nursing. And so I start off with Eve, and Adam calls Eve the mother of all the living, and of course in the ancient world, nursing was a life and death issue. It wasn't a cosmetic issue. And so the means of sustaining life early on for a child was nursing, right? Mm-hmm. And then when you go to Isaiah 66:11, God pictures the new world, the redeemed world, as Jerusalem. He personifies as a woman, and then the people within, the redeemed, are nursing, are actually satisfied at the breasts of Zion. Mm-hmm. So when God looks at the new world, he's looking at it as a woman nursing a child, because of all the comfort and the consolation and the safety and all that good stuff. Well, Psalm chapter 22, verse 9. In Psalm 22, it starts off with, my God, why have you forsaken me? And we know that Psalm 22 is Jesus' inner dialogue on the cross. It's a first-person account. They've pierced my hands and my feet. You're familiar with that text, I'm sure.
Right, yeah.
Well, what's interesting is if you look at verse 9, and of course, at this point, he's abandoned by everyone except for John and the Blessed Mother, and then the women around him. But if you look at verse 9, he's speaking to Yahweh. He says, yet you are he who took me from the womb. You made me trust you at my mother's breasts, which, of course, is speaking of the Blessed Mother.
Right.
And so I was just like, this is just amazing. Is it possible that in Jesus' worst moments, when he's being torn to pieces, abandoned by all of his friends, right, paying for the sins of the world, and he looks back in verse 9 in his humanity, because we know he's God, but we also know he's fully, truly human. Does he look back at his being at his mother's breasts for comfort, knowing that she took care of him? And then he looks down at the cross, and there she is still with him. So it's a very poignant moment for me. I was like, oh, man, maybe my battery will last. Then I'm talking.
All right. Hey, we're back now. So, yes, adventures in technology. So we'll just continue. We had a slight technical malfunction, but now we're back. And so I'm sorry, you were saying, you were talking about the biblical imagery of nursing at the breast of mother.
Yeah, man. So, you know, I don't know if we caught it, but Isaiah 66:11, when God, you know, the end of Isaiah, God pictures the new world. There's my Bible software.
Mm-hmm.
God pictures a new world, and it's personified as a woman nursing a child. It's the woman nursing all the redeemed.
Right.
And in Psalm 22, you have Jesus, his inner dialogue on the cross. He's talking about his hands and feet being pierced. It's quoted directly from the cross. Why have you forsaken me? This is clearly speaking about Christ. And one of the thoughts of Christ on the cross, according to Psalm 22, is you made me to trust in you. Now, again, he's speaking from his humanity, from my mother's breasts. And he's speaking of the time when he was being nursed by his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And the closeness, and it was kind of this crazy, okay, so the mother and the son are absolutely close and have this insane bond that nobody else has, because that's the whole point of nursing, right? It's not just nurturing, it's the bond. But then he also includes the father there, because he says, you know, you made me to trust in you. So it's this crazy picture that Jesus, Mary are together in this ridiculously insane bond, and then the father's there, and they're just encircling one another. It's a beautiful picture. And that, I believe, Jesus is calling back to that, mm-hmm. To bring himself through this horrible ordeal that he's facing. But it was crazy to me, because I'm like, man, he's looking down and looking at his mother who nursed him. And it was just a crazy picture to me. And then, of course, I connected that to Isaiah 66:11, because the way that the new world comes about, we know, is through the cross of Christ.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it says in Isaiah 66:11 that Zion is going to rejoice with Jerusalem and be glad for her. All you who love her, rejoice with her. She's personified as a woman, oddly enough. All you mourn over her, Verse 11, that you may nurse and be satisfied from her consoling breast, that you may drink deeply with delight from her glorious abundance. So it's like, whoa, because Mary, not only did she say yes to carrying Christ and birthing him, but she also said yes to nursing him and just caring for him, especially in the flight to Egypt and all the rest of it. In the ancient world, that was very dangerous, because Psalm 22:9 was there. Isaiah 66:11 is going to be fulfilled. So it was just a very crazy picture for me as a Protestant, whatever you want to say. And I said it on the air that if Mary would have never nursed Christ, Isaiah 66:11 would have never happened. So I'm waiting for the fallout for that. Mm-hmm. But it was a deeply significant moment for me because I realized it literally on the show.
Okay.
As it was happening.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, I mean, this is one of the things that, this is why, you know, Marian piety has always been at the heart of apostolic Christianity. You know, it's a faith that begins literally the last gift Jesus gave his church before he left this world. Well, I'm not talking about the ascension. Before he left his mortal life, I guess I should say.
Sure.
Was Mary. Behold, sure. Your mother. One of the things that's important to recognize, especially with John, is that John is always multivalent. He's always speaking at multiple levels at the same time. He has a deeply sacramental view of the world. And he tells us that, you know, he says that, yeah, I can fill libraries with stories about Jesus, he says, but these things are written so that you may know that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. And so his point is that everything that's recorded in his gospel has this intensely theological significance. Not one syllable of John's gospel is there by accident, partly because, of course, the author of John's gospel is the Holy Spirit, but also because John is himself a literary colossus who really, really crams things into very few words. And so when he tells us the story of the crucifixion, and we have that little vignette, John's the only gospel that records that Mary was at the foot of the cross. None of the synoptics don't record that. So when he gives us that story of Jesus speaking to the disciple that he loved, yes, at the literal level, what John is saying, and by the way, this is one of the reasons that Catholic tradition has always believed in the perpetual virginity of Mary, the normal custom would be, of course, that if you're a mother who has lost her son, if you've got others, children, they're going to take care of you because there's no Social Security Administration in first century Judea.
And then Trump would have came and shut it down anyway.
Right, would have shut it down anyway.
One of his ancestors.
Yes. So what's interesting is that at the literal level, what happens is Jesus commends Mary into John's care. Why John's care? Because there aren't any other kids. And so John is going to take care of Mary. That's the literal level of that story, but it's not the only level of that story, because what John also wants us to see there is a spiritual parable that you, the baptized, are the disciple Jesus loves.
You know what's funny?
It is to you that he's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what's interesting to me is... And I'm thinking out loud here.
Yeah.
Because, of course, I have my Protestant answers.
Sure.
So in John chapter 7, it says not even his own brothers believed in him.
Right.
And so I'm a devotee of John. I'm a disciple of John. I read John probably all the way through once a week.
Right.
So on the one hand, I say, okay, well, he didn't give Mary to Jesus' physical brothers because it said explicitly in chapter 7 that not even his own brothers believed in him. And we can talk about Adel Foss and all the rest of it. But what I will say, though, that you bring up a compelling point that has to be contended with by me as well as any other Protestant. John, there is a pattern in the Gospel of John that Jesus will say something, and then he has a deeper spiritual meaning that gets misunderstood if taken literally.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, he says, you have to be born again. Nicodemus says, oh, what are you talking about?
Right.
And in chapter 2, he says, destroy this temple. 3 days, I'll bring it up. Right. And then they say, well, it took us 46 years to build the temple. In chapter 4, he says, he tells the woman at the well, I can give you water. You'll never thirst again. She takes him literally. Give me this water. Chapter 9, he tells the Pharisees that he came to heal the blind and that they were blind, but they didn't take it. So when I see him giving, saying, behold your son, I do have to agree with you at some level that John, there's a purposefulness in that. That's beyond that I feel like if you just took the literal understanding of it, you would be committing the same error as the rest of the audience in the book of John, in the Gospel of John.
Right.
Because every time they took him literally, they missed the point.
Right.
Or left it. Well, let me say it this way. Left it at the literal level. They missed the point. So I can't disagree with you. You know what's interesting to me? In C.S. Lewis's, who is an accepted by Protestants, is you know.
Uh-huh.
I'm just going to leave that there.
Right.
Do you know what girls are called in Narnia? So boys are called sons of Adam.
Oh.
Girls are called
daughters of Eve.
Daughters of Eve.
Right.
And what's interesting to me is, so here's my argument. Why is it that Eve can justly be called our mother,
mm-hmm.
but Mary would not be?
Right.
Especially considering Eve... And God, I love Eve. There's a special place in my heart for Eve as well. However, right. Eve was the one that brought all this sin upon us, or at least assisted in doing so.
Right.
Mary is the vehicle by which our salvation came about.
Right.
So if a woman can rightly be called the daughter of Eve, why couldn't our sisters be called daughters of Mary?
Sure.
Or me.
Sure.
Especially considering when Jesus says, enmity between the woman, your seed, and her seed, and all the rest of it.
Right.
The woman there, okay, on one level I can say the woman is Eve.
Sure.
But the most direct fulfillment of that prophecy has to be the Blessed Mother.
Right. You know, man, you and Irenaeus have a lot to talk about.
If that's the case, then could we not say at some level that we are her seed?
Sure.
Because as you know, the term zerah there is singular and plural. It functions like fish.
Right.
So I believe that Christ is obviously the seed of the woman, but it's also a plural word that right. the woman also has seeds. And right. Paul makes that point in Galatians between the seed of Abraham and all the rest of it. So to me, I think you're right. I think what Jesus is saying is that... And if I was to channel Lewis here, that the changeover from, okay, a new creation is happening.
Right.
So I got a new Adam here.
Right.
And you guys are no longer going to be the seed of Eve. You're going to be the seed of the woman, the seed of Mary. And in that sense. And, you know, Paul talks about this. The Jerusalem below is in slavery with her children.
Mm-hmm.
The Jerusalem above is free, and she is our mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, from a human perspective, everything that Jerusalem was supposed to be, I think Mary embodies in the feminine sense. I think everything Israel embodies, Christ embodies in the physical sense.
You see, worst Protestant ever, man.
I am. But I think it's beautiful, and I love biblical theology. I love Genesis to Revelation theology.
Yeah,
and I've been stuck in Genesis 3 for about 3 years. Ever since we planted the church,
mm-hmm.
I've been stuck in Genesis 3 because there's so much depth to that.
Yeah,
And so a lot of the stuff I'm saying for the first time, because I don't have a lot of Roman Catholics to bounce off my ideas off of.
No, this is all perfectly, this is something that would make sense to any theologian from any church in the apostolic tradition, not merely the Catholic Church, but the Orthodox Church. Chaldeans would go for this. The Copts would completely grok this. And this goes all the way back to John. You can also find this reflected in the book of Revelation, particularly in the 12th chapter of Revelation, which is an intensely and obviously, at least to anybody from an apostolic church, this is an obviously Marian reference. So I saw a woman clothed with the sun, crowned with 12 stars. Why 12? Well, 12 tribes of Israel. She gives birth to a male child who will rule the nations with an iron scepter. The dragon tries to kill not only her child, but then goes off.
Seed.
But yeah, to attack the rest of her children. Who are the rest? Who are the rest of her children? Well, that doesn't mean the brothers and sisters of Jesus in the physical sense. It means the baptized.
And of course, you know, and I just thought of another passage where it talks about Rachel weeping for her children.
Right.
And, you know, again, Rachel was one of the matriarchs of the Jewish nation.
Right.
And so when Jewish children are being killed,
right,
they're children of Rachel.
Right.
So it's crazy to me that this even sounds bad coming out of my mouth as a Protestant to say,
right,
okay, Eve's the mother of all the living. She's my mother. Absolutely. I will own Eve. Mm-hmm. Rachel, yep. You know, I'm spiritual Israel, so Rachel's my mom. Why couldn't I take the one who's blessed above all of them as my mother?
Right. And whose yes is the gateway for the incarnation. You know, one of the staggering things about the Christian tradition is that it really it takes, well, the Judeo-Christian tradition does, but here we see in the yes of Mary just how enormously important our choices are, that we're given real choices, that our choices matter. And Mary's choice matters. She's not an automaton. And so it's through her yes, which paradoxically, of course, is known from the foundation of the world, because things don't sneak up on God, you know? It's not like God was going, I wonder what's going to happen here, you know? But at the same time, it was a free choice. And it was a choice that absolutely matters. And so, you know, when Irenaeus says that...
And she had to continue choosing. That's the other thing.
Well, yeah.
That's why the nursing thing was really important to me, because this is this continuous action where she's continuously sacrificing herself for this cause and for this child.
Yeah. And becomes, in her own way, this would become particularly important in the High Middle Ages. The image of it, not surprisingly, you know, there's a number of reasons for this. There are theological reasons for this, but there are also sociological reasons for this. When you're living in a time where the infant mortality rate is staggering,
yes,
that far more children die than live. The image
and
of
mothers die,
right? And the image of Our Lady of Sorrows, then it's going to matter a lot.
Uh-huh.
And but it's a real theological point as well, because what is often overlooked in the dynamic between Mary. This is something that was pointed out to me several years back, which I had never seen. But think about this. The last wound that Christ suffered was not endured by him. It was endured by Mary. Think about that. Sword will pierce your heart also. Jesus never felt the sword thrust because he was already dead, but Mary felt it because she had to watch it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you think about that, and you think about yesterday I got an email from a friend of mine she was asking for prayer because a mother and a father that she knew, they had a little baby, a little one-year-old baby. And that baby somehow or other, there was a curtain cord or something like that that got into the baby's crib. And the long and the short of it is the baby accidentally strangled on the cord and died.
Wow.
You think about the anguish that those parents go through as they, you know, their baby that they love died. Think about what Mary went through during the crucifixion. You know, we say kind of cavalierly, well, Mary didn't die for her. So you'll hear this kind of dismissive, you know, language applied to Mary. Well, we don't owe Mary anything. She didn't die for our sins. Jesus died for our sins. You're taking away glory from Jesus if you, you know, if you talk about Mary suffering and so forth. Well, when Paul talks about suffering in Colossians, he talks about filling up, which is language that only Paul can get away with because it's in the Bible, right? If a Catholic talks this way, you know, we hear, idolatry and blasphemy and all the rest of it.
We'd light you on fire for sure.
Right, right.
Hey, talk about filling up the sufferings of Christ.
Filling up the sufferings of Christ with respect to the sufferings of Christ for the sake of his body, the church. In other words, what Paul is saying is that our sufferings can be joined to the sufferings of Jesus, and they really matter, and they really do something good for other people, just as Jesus' sufferings do, because they're united with Christ. Well, Mary is the first person to go through that. And well, so when well, as a Christian,
yes, I mean,
but
well, no, let me
finish. So when we talk about the sufferings of Jesus, you know, the point that the thing that really struck me, I wrote about this several years ago, I was writing about the rosary. That, you know, we hear about we think about David. Oh, Absalom, Absalom, my son, would to God that I had died instead of you. Every right. parent who has ever lost a child has felt that. And this was Mary's suffering. And so when you look at the crucifixion, yes, Jesus's role in the passion and in our redemption and the economy of salvation was to hang on the cross. Mary's role, and it's just as full of anguish in many, many ways. She's not God, but Mary's role in the passion was to not hang on the cross. Think about that.
Yeah.
You know, as any parent, she would have said, and I'm sure must have said, would to God that I had to go through this rather than you. But she couldn't,
I think the suffering of Mary was very singular in
yeah.
the sense that
no one has the relationship.
Number one, the worst fear that you have as a parent is losing a child.
Right.
But what people don't realize is that I think it was Simon there when they were dedicating him at the temple. I think at some level she understood that her son was going to die. So imagine going through raising this boy, loving him, taking care of him, but knowing he's going to die the entire time. Some people say, oh, that's preparation. I think it's terrible. I think it's horrible suffering to know that your child is going to die a horrible, brutal death. And then of course it gets consummated in that moment.
Yeah.
And it's very poignant. And I think when I look at, you know, I'm doing a lot of work and thinking through men and women and our roles. And when I think about, you know, Paul has this cryptic phrase, a woman will be saved through childbearing.
Yeah,
if she continues in faith and all this stuff, and of course, a woman did save us through childbearing.
Yeah, yeah.
In the sense, you know, of course, you have to qualify the thing to death. But yeah, she's definitely a unique. You know, obviously, with me, the Liguori stuff, where you know, to me now we're putting her on an equivalent, and I don't really know your opinion on the Liguori stuff, but some of the stuff that guy says to me is just way out of bounds and something that I don't think the Blessed Mother would even appreciate.
Uh-huh.
So I can't go there. But
there's a wide variety. I mean, within Catholic piety, there's a ton of variety. And what the church basically does is say, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom. Well, seriously, you can take or leave Liguori. You don't have to. I don't think I've ever read Alphonsus Liguori on Mary.
I've studied him eminently.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Protestants worry about this stuff a lot more than Catholics do.
Well, no, JP2 said, he said, hey, if you want to know about Mary, talk to Liguori. Of course, JP2 was very devoted to.
Well, and he had an intense devotion to Our Lady, too.
Yeah, he had an extreme devotion.
Yeah, so I don't worry about stuff like that. Because my attitude is if the church says it's within the bounds, then that's fine. It doesn't mean you have to do anything about it. But I think, you know, the points that you're making here are deeply Catholic. You're getting what Saint Irenaeus is talking about. Any Orthodox theologian, little O or big O, would get.
Now I'm asking you as a friend now. Serious question.
Ask away.
Why do you think? Because I do know in the early church there's heavy emphasis on Mary and a ton of Marian literature. Why do you think the New Testament sort of doesn't give her that type of attention?
Well,
I'm not asking this as an apologist. I'm just asking this as a serious.
Well, it does, but remember that the New Testament has, as I never tire of saying, the Bible is not intended to be the big book of everything. That's just not its point. So there isn't, I mean, for a Catholic or an Orthodox or an Eastern Church reader, the New Testament gives...
Shout out to Hank Hanegraaff.
Well, yeah. But the New Testament does give plenty of attention to Mary. Sure. Luke's entire infancy narrative tells you practically everything you need to know about Mary. In Catholic teaching. You know, Mary only shows up twice in the Gospel of John, but the way in which she shows up there is so packed with meaning.
Highly significant.
Hugely significant.
I'm still confused about Jesus' response to her and then his actions after. Because he goes, what does this have to do with us? You know, John 2. What does this have to do with us? And then he goes and does it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Like, sure. Well, because a couple of background points here. Sure. What you're seeing there, remember, this is John's theological reflection written in light of 60 years by the time the gospel is written of Catholic practice and Catholic piety, which includes... a piety that is intensely Marian. This is something that's already been written after, I'm speaking as a Catholic here, but I'm also speaking as an apostolic Christian who has 70% of Christendom in his back pocket, not just the Catholic Church. This is written after the Assumption, which the early church takes for granted.
You're talking about the Assumption of Mary?
The Assumption of Mary, which the early church takes for granted. And all the apostolic churches take it for granted. And that's part of it is, so two things. Paul doesn't talk much about Mary because when Paul's writing, he's primarily writing to put out pastoral fires about other things. So the big issues in the early church don't center on Mary. The big issues in the early church center on ethnic quarrels between Jews and Gentiles. And that's what Paul's fires are mostly about. Why does he have to write Romans? Why does he have to write Galatians? Why does he have to write Ephesians? He's writing those documents primarily because he's got early Christian community, mixed ethnic communities of Jews and Gentiles who are arguing very much like patients in a cancer ward arguing about which one of them is the least terminal.
Yes.
And so his main point is to say, stop fighting about who's more important, Jews and Gentiles. That's what Romans is about. That's what Galatians is about. So you got that going on. And so in a funny way, Marian piety doesn't come up in Paul's writings because it's not an issue. Nobody's fighting about it.
Okay. So that's your, but yes, it's an apologetic or a polemical issue. I could see why that would be.
Right.
But as a devotional issue, why don't we see any Marian devotion in the New Testament?
You do see Marian devotion in the New Testament. You see Mary as the ideal disciple at the wedding at Cana. And what's John's typically economical summary of all of Marian devotion? I can tell you in just a couple of words, do whatever he tells you. That's right. Marian devotion. That's Mary's word to the servants. What you have in the confrontation between Mary and Jesus, so-called, is you have the importunate disciple going and doing exactly what Jesus says to do in his instructions on prayer. So she goes to Jesus and says, they have no wine, just like the woman goes to the judge and says, give me justice.
Mm-hmm.
And because, of course, remember, Mary is the one that taught Jesus his Bible, right? Jesus right. was homeschooled. What do the prophets say about the Messianic age? Isaiah tells us what the Messianic age is going to be all about. There's going to be a ton of wine.
Yes,
and
I agree with that.
And so what does Mary do? She goes in this incredibly significant way. You could practically see her raising her eyebrows, you know, saying, they have no wine.
Right.
And what is Jesus' response to her? Jesus' response makes absolutely no sense unless the subtext of Mary's words are, show yourself.
Right.
If that's what Mary's saying, and the whole Catholic tradition says that's exactly what Mary is saying, then that whole conversation makes sense. Because Jesus...
But he says, okay, so how do you interpret him saying, what does this have to do with us? It's not my time.
My hour's not yet come.
Yeah,
he will talk about his hour later in John's
Gospel. Yeah, he does it multiple times. He does it
right.
in chapter 4, 7, 8.
Right. And 18. And at every point... He says his hour has not yet come until the moment the Gentiles come to him in John
right.
chapter 12. And then he says, now the hour has come.
Right. Yeah, the Greeks come to see him.
And the hour
come to see him, realizes right. it's time.
And the hour is his death. That's what his hour is. And so what she's saying is begin your mission. And John will describe the miracle that he does as the first of his signs.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't merely mean first numerically, the first in line. What he means is this is the archetypal sign.
Right.
This is the one that explains all the other signs that you're going to see in the book of seven signs.
Right.
And the sign is nuptial. This, by the
yes.
way, also has to do with the perpetual virginity of Mary, because there are two virgins in John's gospel. One of them is Mary. The other one is Jesus. And John's gospel is just absolutely cram-packed with nuptial significance. So it begins with the miracle at Cana, which happens, by the way, on the seventh day in John's gospel. So we count off at the beginning of John's gospel, which starts with the very arch-significant words in the beginning. So it's taking you right back to Genesis, and then it says, you know, the next day... Jesus went here, and the day after that, Jesus did this, and the next day, and the next day. And then he starts the story of the wedding at Cana with the words, on the third day, so 4 plus 3. So he's, again, being John, he crams tons of significance in that because the third day is John's way of hitting you on the side of the head and saying, pay attention, this is super important because the third day means a lot right. in the Christian tradition, right? And so we have this moment that begins with a wedding. And the next day, or the next scene, John chapter 3, you have the delegation that goes to Jerusalem and goes and talks to John the Baptist and asks him who he is. And what is John's reply? I'm not the bridegroom. Jesus, over there in chapter 2 at the wedding, he's the bridegroom.
Right.
So more nuptial significance. And then the scene after that is John chapter 4, where Jesus is again talking to a woman. He's talking to her at a well. Wells have huge nuptial significance, especially in the Old Testament tradition, because people are constantly meeting their wives there. So Abraham right. sends the servant off to find somebody for Isaac, and he stops at a well, and he meets Rebekah. And Moses flees the Egyptians, and he stops at a well, and he meets Zipporah. And, you know, so again, and not surprising that a well would have that kind of significance, because in a desert culture, wells are signs of life and fertility and so forth. So their whole conversation that he has with the woman at the well is all about marriage.
Right.
And the the marriage backdrop to this is doubly significant, because once again, we're talking about John, who works at multiple levels. So the Samaritans, are there, the Samaritans exist at all because of an act of ethnic cleansing committed by the Assyrians about 7 centuries before, where they went in, they rolled into the northern kingdom of Israel, wiped it out, scattered the 10 tribes to, you know, the four corners of the world, and then moved in. You can read about this in 1 and 2 Kings. They then import, like good ethnic cleansers do, they import 5 nations, 5 pagan nations into the area that had been the northern kingdom of Israel. And those nations then start to intermingle with the remnant of the Israelites that are still there. They start to intermarry and marry each other and so forth. Well, each one of those nations brings with them their own cultic deity called a Baal. And Baal means, do you remember what Baal means?
Husband.
Yes, husband. So he's talking to a Samaritan, and he's saying, you Samaritan woman have already had 5 Baals. That's the language that they're talking in, Aramaic. You've already had 5 Baals, and the one you're with now is not your Baal.
Whoa.
Who's the one she's with now? I mean, right now. Talking to her. Yeah.
Christ, right?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So all of a sudden, we are pulled into the entire Israelite prophetic tradition, which constantly talks about God as husband to his people. This is Hosea. This is Ezekiel doing this as well, and other prophets as well. So you got, again, this whole nuptial subtext going on between Jesus, who's talking to the woman. So the woman is, at the literal level, she's this woman who's there at the well, getting her, you know, she's there at noon. Why is she there at noon? Because all the decent women went there in the morning when, right. when it was still cool. She goes there at noon when nobody's there because everybody despises her because she's had 5 husbands. But what Jesus is doing there is he's also talking to the to the woman of Samaria, as in the daughter of Zion.
Right.
So this symbolic figure who represents the whole Samaritan people, and saying to the Samaritan people, you've had 5 husbands, and the one you're with now is not your husband. And so that's the subtext. And so when we get finally to the only other time in John's gospel where Mary appears, she's only in his gospel twice. Seems like not much, right? But we've had, at the beginning, we've had this massive symbolic conversation with Mary as the model disciple saying, show yourself, you know, begin the process of wooing, if you will, the daughter of Zion. And now, when you, the other time that Mary shows up in John's gospel is at the crucifixion. That's the only other time. And in the story of the crucifixion, what you've got in John's gospel, and it's going to be reflected, by the way, in John's apocalypse as well, is the consummation of the marriage. So Jesus has ridden into Jerusalem, and by that act, he has announced himself as the Son of David. That's what a Son of David does. It's what Solomon did when he entered into his reign. He didn't ride into Jerusalem on a war horse. He rode into Jerusalem on an ass. And so when John records Jesus riding into Jerusalem on an ass, what he's saying is, this is the Son of David. Everybody gets that. That's why the Pharisees are so ticked, right? Tell these people to shut up. Stop saying that. And Jesus doesn't say, oh, I'm sorry, people are just getting carried away. Jesus says, if these were silent, the stones would cry out. They get it. You know? And if we're not clear on who Jesus is, 5 days later, Pilate will put a really helpful sign over Jesus' head explaining exactly who Jesus is. Jesus Nazarenus Rex Iudaeorum, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. So this is all about the Son of David. Well, how does the Son of David enter on his reign? Or how does David enter on his reign, rather? Well, when David enters on his reign, what happens, if you go back, you read 2 Samuel. After the death of Saul, the elders of Israel come to David, and they say to him, in really loaded language, "We are flesh of your flesh and bone of your bone." Where have you heard that before in the Israelite tradition?
Right.
That is nuptial language, right? So right. when they ask him to be king, they're not asking him to be president of Israel or prime minister of Israel. You seem like a competent handler of temple treasury funds. You know, that's not what we're looking at. We're looking at the Israelite understanding of king. And king means father and husband, as well as, you know, warrior and all the rest of it. And so the language that they use is nuptial language.
Right.
Well, now we've got Jesus hanging on the cross, and standing across from him, recorded only in John's gospel, is the other virgin in this story. This consecrate, and virginity means consecration. That's why Jesus is a virgin, because he's consecrated. He's already got a girl. That girl is the church. And so as Jesus hangs on the cross, John records, and again, John is the only one that records this, as he dies, they pierce his side, and from his side comes blood and water. And John isn't recording that because he thought you might be interested in the medical details of pericardial rupture. He's recording that because, as he tells us in his first letter, there are three witnesses, he says, the spirit, the water, and the blood. That water is not just water for John. That is the font of baptism. That is the water that comes from the new temple that's been destroyed, Ezekiel's temple. Remember the story of Ezekiel's vision, right?
Yeah.
And there's the water that flows from the doorstep of the temple and then flows out toward the Dead Sea and becomes this huge river. That vision is what's being celebrated, as well as the water from the rock, in John chapter 7, when Jesus says, out of whoever believes in me, out of his belly will flow rivers of living water, right? He's not at just any feast. He's at the Feast of Booths. And what's being celebrated there, among other things, is the water from the temple. In fact, there was actually a rite that was performed every time that feast was celebrated, where the priest would process from the temple down to the Pool of Siloam with a golden ewer. They would fill it with water. Then they would go up to the steps of the temple, and they would pour that water out on the steps of the temple as a reminder of Ezekiel's vision, and as a reminder of the water from the rock. And it's during that feast that Jesus starts talking about the water that you know, that God will cause to well up in all who believe in him. And so this is all baptismal imagery. And so when Jesus outside his beers. That's what John has in mind. Well, he's also got in mind, of course, the creation of the new Eve, the bride of Adam. And who's Jesus? Jesus is the last Adam.
Right.
So what you've got is this image then of the last Adam giving birth to the new Eve. And who is standing there at the foot of the cross? The only person recording this is John. It's the Blessed Virgin Mary, this consecrated virgin, who is his model disciple, and who is, as Irenaeus gets, she is the new Eve. She's the model of all the disciples. And so you are absolutely right when you get that Mary is your mother. And Jesus will drive that home. He just drove it home a couple of minutes before his death by saying to you and all the baptized, everybody who's been washed in that water from the side of Christ, behold your mother. So that is, you know, that's... It's, so when you start to unpack it, yeah, it doesn't look like John's talking too much about Mary, but man, you know, and when you get to the book of Revelation, same thing. I mean, it's all nuptial imagery. It consummates, after all, with the marriage feast of the Lamb.
Right.
And you know, I saw the New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven dressed as a bride, you know. So yeah, this, it doesn't seem like much, but there's tons crammed in there. And once you see it, you can't not see it. Once you see, for example, that Luke really is likening Mary to the Ark of the Covenant, the holiest object in the entire Old Testament. You know, when he records the angel saying that the power of the Most High will overshadow you, Gabriel uses the same word in Greek that's used to describe the Shekinah coming down on the tabernacle in the Ark of the Covenant. Well, and why? Well, what's in the Ark of the Covenant? The Ten Commandments, the manna, and kept with it is the staff of Aaron. Well, who's in the womb of Mary? Well, the Word of God, the bread of life, and the high priest. And Luke will particularly drive home this Eucharistic connection with Jesus. So there's a reason Luke records that Jesus is put in a manger, because a manger is a feed box. And so he'll, at the front of his gospel, he has this Eucharistic reference, and Bethlehem means house of bread.
Right.
And at the end of his gospel, he will again make this Eucharistic reference. So Jesus meets the disciples on the Emmaus Road and does the first Christian Bible study with them, and it all goes right past them. They still don't get it, right? The moment that they get it is the moment that Jesus takes bread, gives thanks, breaks it, and gives it to his disciples, which is ought to be a gesture that's familiar.
Right.
And so, yeah, so you get this Eucharistic bracket, and Mary is all tied up with that, because Mary is, particularly in Luke's thinking, Mary is the source of the incarnation. It is from her that he gets his flesh and blood that are offered on the cross and in the Eucharist. So, that's why Luke spends so much time on Mary in the first couple of chapters. After that, she kind of drops out. She pops in a couple of times to the Synoptic Gospels, but Luke's Marian devotion is the most profound of the Synoptic Gospels. And what's interesting to me is that Luke gets his gospel in huge measure from Paul. So don't underestimate Paul's Marian devotion merely because he doesn't talk about her a lot in his letters. He's doing something else in his letters. If you want to see, I suspect, If you want to see Paul's understanding of Mary, look at Luke.
Because Paul is to Luke what Peter is to Mark.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I think that, you know, what you're seeing reflected in Luke's gospel is a gospel that Luke got, not exclusively from Paul. Luke's got other sources. But you'll see Paul's theology a lot in Luke. And Luke will do it in subtle ways. So there's a really interesting passage, for example, in Luke's gospel. Let me see if I can find it. There's a really fascinating moment in Luke's gospel where he puts two sayings of Jesus together that don't seem to have much of anything to do with one another. Where he's talking about divorce, but he also the passage before that is this saying that has to do with the law and the prophets. And you look at it and you go, why are these two sayings together? And they don't seem to make any sense together. But when you read Romans 7, all of a sudden it makes perfect sense. Because what Luke's doing is he's taking these two sayings of Jesus, and he's making exactly the same point that Paul makes in Romans 7. And once that you put that together, then it all makes sense. So he puts these two sayings together. They're right next to one another. The law and the prophets were until John. Since then, the good news of the kingdom of God is preached, and everyone enters it violently. But it is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one dot of the law to become void. Okay, so that's the first saying of Jesus. And then immediately after that, Luke says, everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, and he who marries a woman divorced from her husband commits adultery. And you look at that and go, why are these two sayings together? Well, when you read Romans 7, that's exactly the same point that Paul is making. He's saying, if you're a Jew, you're bound by the law. And the only way you get out of that is by dying. And that's exactly what happens to you when you're baptized. You die to the law.
Yeah, okay.
And now you're married to Christ. And so you could see Paul's theology reflected in the way that Luke is ordering his sayings material from Jesus. So I think that that's significant. And I think that part of the reason it's significant is when you go back and you start reading Luke and the amount of time and energy that Luke spends on Mary, I think that's where you're really getting Paul's attitude to Mary. But when Paul's writing his letters, he's not writing a treatise on Marian devotion. He's trying to, you know, patch up the screwiness in Corinth, or he's dealing with, you know, the quarrels over circumcision that are happening in Galatia, and he's just talking about other things. And the closest that Paul ever gets to trying to write something like a theological treatise will be in either Romans or Ephesians. The rest of the time, he's kind of dealing with putting out pastoral fires. And sorry for this big harangue.
No. That's I'm gonna, you know, when I get something in my teeth, I just keep picking at it and picking at it. So
yeah,
it's gonna be a while.
Well, let me tell you, you are on the right track with Mary. You're getting it. You're getting a lot of it. And this is that's the Holy Spirit at work, as far as I'm concerned.
Man.
All right. So, well, I don't really know where to go after this, but are there other things that you want to talk about? We've been doing this for a good while, so the podcast can't go on forever. But if you got any closing remarks, then speak now or forever hold your peace. How's that?
I think for pro-life or right-wing Catholics and evangelicals or whatever we want to label ourselves, we're going to have to really pray for our nation.
Yeah.
Because the road to hell is paved with good intentions, apparently. And, we are on the precipice. We really are.
Yeah. It's a tragic day. I hope that the Senate says this bill is a piece of garbage and turns it down, but I have no confidence that they're going to. And it's a tragedy to watch, you know, pro-life people so happy that people, you know, well, I just read an article today. Cancer patients will now enjoy a $140,000 deductible before they are actually covered by insurance. So,
it's maddening.
It is maddening.
Well, thanks, Andrew, for having me on your show, man.
I want to thank you for being on. This was so much fun. And I'm sure we'll have you back in the past. Yes, it was great. Well, I'll be happy to do your show whenever you want me. So,
yeah, man.
Let me know. All right. Well, Andrew March, I want to thank you for being on the show. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we'll be back next week with another talk with somebody about something or other. We'll find out then. Bye-bye.
Bye.